Today is Thursday, January 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Wednesday was a day of remembrance for those lost to the coronavirus pandemic.
It's the most harrowing experience of my life, and it will haunt me.
And the Holocaust.
76 years after the Shoah, we should all be alarmed by the rise of anti-Semitism and racism.
We'll have these stories and more next. Britain has surpassed 100,000 coronavirus deaths, making it one of the worst affected countries in the world. Henry Ridgewell starts us off.
86-year-old Gordon Bonner says he is lost in a hinterland of despair and desolation. It's 9 months since Muriel, his wife of 63 years, died from COVID-19. He was called to her bedside for the final moments.
And I sat for the next hour and watch Muriel drown in her own body fluids. It's the most harrowing experience of my life, and it will haunt me. And I'll tell you why. Such was her fight for oxygen that she was sucking at the air and I can still see her face now, and her lips formed a perfect circle as if she was sucking through a straw.
A haunting account of loss and grief, emotions that have touched families across the country. Britain Tuesday became the first European country to report 100,000 coronavirus deaths. 25,000 of those have occurred in the past 3 weeks. It now has the highest coronavirus death rate per capita in the world. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Wednesday he shared the nation's grief.
But I and the government take full responsibility for all the actions I have taken, we've taken during this pandemic to fight this disease. And yes, Mr. Speaker, there will indeed be a time when we must learn the lessons of what has happened.
Johnson announced an extension of school closures and the enforced quarantine of travellers arriving from high-risk countries. Critics say he's done too little, too late. Critics, including opposition Labour Party leader Keir Starmer, say he's done too little, too late.
The Prime Minister was slow into the first lockdown last March. He was slow in getting protective equipment to the front line, slow to protect our care homes, slow on testing and tracing, slow into the second lockdown in the autumn, slow to change the Christmas mixing rules, slow again into this third lockdown.
Many scientists blame underinvestment in the National Health Service. Lawrence Young is an infectious diseases expert at the University of Warwick.
We suffered from not having an adequate public health infrastructure in this country. We didn't get test, trace and isolate right, and that's still a big challenge for this country. So keeping a lid on infections by effective testing, tracing, and then encouraging people to isolate is really important, and we didn't get border control right.
While Britain leads Europe in coronavirus deaths, it is way ahead in its vaccination program. Close to 7 million people have received their first vaccine doses. Again, Lawrence Young.
And it should mean that come March time, we're in a much stronger position in terms of being able to review the current lockdown restrictions.
But there are growing concerns of a vaccine shortage. Drug firms AstraZeneca and Pfizer warned the European Union this week of delays as production systems are scaled up to meet demand. The EU has threatened to block exports of vaccines produced in Europe. Meanwhile, the British government says the public should be prepared for further bad news. Chris Whitty is Britain's chief medical officer.
Unfortunately, we're going to see quite a lot more deaths over the next few weeks before the effects of the vaccines begin to be felt.
So, tragically, thousands more families will have to endure the grief of losing loved ones before their time. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In additional COVID-19-related news, the new head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention predicted on Wednesday that the COVID-19 death toll in the United States would surpass 500,000 by February 20th. And in South Africa, that nation is preparing to roll out its first vaccines to the country's frontline healthcare workers. The country's health minister says the delivery of 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine is expected to arrive at the Johannesburg International Airport on Monday, and that there are plans for jabs to be given to doctors and nurses starting in mid-February. A somber United Nations ceremony in tribute to those who perished in Nazi death camps was dominated by fear that the lessons of the Holocaust were being lost and forgotten. Lisa Schlein reports.
Israeli pianist Amit Viner and violinist Amit Ifrach set the tone of this solemn ceremony with selected pieces from composer Mordechai Gebertig's music In Times of Tragedy, the music from the Holocaust. The mood fit the desolation of the UN auditorium, largely empty because crowds are discouraged in this time of coronavirus. In his remarks on this occasion, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres noted this year's anniversary ceremony was taking place under the shadow of COVID-19. He said the pandemic revealed long-standing injustices and contributed to the resurgence of anti-Semitism and xenophobia.
Today, white supremacists and neo-Nazis are resurgent, organizing and recruiting across borders, intensifying their efforts to deny, distort, and rewrite history, including the Holocaust.
Israeli ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Mayrav Aylon-Shahar, honored the 6 million Jews who were exterminated in the Holocaust. On this day, 76 years ago, she noted Auschwitz-Birkenau camp, the symbol of Hitler's final solution, was liberated. She said at the end of World War II, the world pledged never again.
But here we are, today, 76 years after the Shoah. We should all be alarmed by the rise of anti-Semitism and racism, and when Holocaust denial is on the rise.
90-year-old Holocaust survivor Fanny Ben-Ami recounted in gripping detail how she, as a 13-year-old girl, along with 22 other children, escaped to Switzerland by ruse, good luck, and great courage. She survived, but her mother, father, and uncle were killed in the Nazi concentration camps. Her words are spoken by an interpreter.
I'm not a survivor of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. I ran away. I was not in the camps. I was not beaten. I didn't suffer, and I didn't get thin. I didn't wear one of those striped suits. So finally, despite everything, those of us who came back from the war are Nitzolei HaShoah, as they call us, the people of the Shoah, the people of the Holocaust.
German ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Michael Freiherr von Ungern-Sternberg, paid homage to Fanny Ben-Ami. He said her testimony sent shivers down his spine in light of rising anti-Semitism, hatred, and racism around the world. While we cannot undo the horrors of the past, he said, humanity holds a shared responsibility to prevent genocide in the future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Numerous studies over the years have emphasized how important getting a good night's sleep is for our health. Researchers at Northwestern University near Chicago, who examined the brain activity and behavior of fruit flies, say they found that deep sleep has a primordial restorative ability to clear waste material from the brain. Among these waste products of the brain may include toxic proteins that the researchers say could lead to neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. If you're wondering why the experiments were conducted with fruit flies, it's that while these tiny bugs are very different from humans, the researchers say the brain neurons that control their circadian rhythms or sleep-wake cycles are very much like our own. The Northwestern University findings are included in a study published in the journal Science Advances. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Russia's upper and lower houses of parliament voted on Wednesday to ratify the extension of the New START nuclear arms control treaty, following a phone call between Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Joe Biden on the previous day. Reuters' Adam Reed takes it from here.
Russia's parliament has approved an extension of the last major nuclear weapons treaty remaining with the United States, a key step forward to preserving the cornerstone of global arms control. The treaty, called New START, was last signed in 2010. It was set to expire next week and limits the number of strategic nuclear warheads, missiles and bombers that Russia and the United States can deploy. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov confirmed to the lower house that the agreement is to extend the treaty for a further 5 years without any changes being made to it. The TASS news agency also quoted him as saying the deal had been agreed on our terms. Moscow and Washington had failed to agree an extension under former US President Donald Trump, who wanted to attach certain conditions to the renewal. However, after President Joe Biden spoke with Vladimir Putin on Tuesday, they agreed their team should work urgently to complete the extension before the February 5th expiry.
Reuters reporter Adam Reed. Yemeni officials say a senior security official was found dead in the southern port city of Aden just one day after his abduction. Officials say Brigadier Ibrahim Harad was abducted late on Tuesday in front of his house in an Aden district. His body was found in the same district Wednesday with multiple bullet wounds. No group has so far claimed responsibility for Harad's abduction and death. Yemen has been convulsed by civil war since 2014, with Iran-backed Houthi rebels on one side and the internationally recognized government, which is supported by a Saudi-led coalition, on the other. The United States has issued a national terrorism alert warning of potential homegrown violent extremism after President Biden's election. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The Homeland Security Department's bulletin does not cite a specific threat, but rather what it calls a heightened threat environment across the nation. It warns of the potential for lingering violence by people motivated by anti-government sentiment, specifically mentioning perceived grievances fueled by false narratives. The warning signals the Biden administration's effectively wading into the politically charged debate over how to characterize acts motivated by political ideology, and suggesting it sees violence aimed at overturning the election as comparable to terrorism. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Through a series of executive actions this week, U.S. President Joe Biden outlined a racial equality agenda the White House says will support communities of color and other underserved communities. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara has those details.
No justice, no peace.
The quest for racial justice has been front and center in the U.S. since the death of George Floyd in police custody last May.
It was the knee on the neck of justice, and it wouldn't be forgotten. It stirred the conscience and of tens of millions of Americans. And in my view, it marked a turning point in this country's attitude toward racial justice.
On Tuesday, President Joe Biden signed four executive orders that the White House says will advance racial equity for Americans who have been underserved and left behind.
These aren't feel-good policies. The evidence is clear. Investing in equity is good for economic growth, and it creates jobs for all Americans.
Biden's actions reversed several Trump administration policies. He directed agencies to strengthen anti-discrimination laws on federal housing and end the Justice Department's use of private prisons, which activists say compound racial disparities. While the rate of black imprisonment has decreased in recent years, it is still more than five times the rate of white incarceration.
If you have a for-profit system that then pays people based upon the number of people in it, they're going to want to put more and more people in it. And so the incentives are all wrong in terms of being able to deal with the better societal objectives of public safety and the rehabilitation of members of our society.
Biden is also recommitting the U.S. government to better consultation with the nation's 574 federally recognized Native American tribes. And he wants to combat discrimination against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders that intensified in the early days of the pandemic.
People who look Asian, people who look Chinese are being identified as having the virus.
Biden's push for equity, distributing resources with focus on the needs of minorities, is criticized by conservatives who say true equality means giving everyone the same resources no matter who they are.
The definition of equity by the left is unequal treatment in order to obtain equal outcomes. That is not who we are. That is what Marxism pretends to do, to obtain equal outcomes. We do not have equal outcomes. We allow people to flourish.
Biden's racial equity agenda seeks to deliver for people who helped him win the White House. Black voters make up 11% of the electorate in 2020, and more than 90% of them voted for Biden. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
As President Biden continues to fill out his cabinet with newly confirmed Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense General Lloyd Austin, what challenges face the administration in South Asia? Well, that's the discussion that VOA Asia host Ira Melman had with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center.
Well, keeping in mind that Biden's initial focus will be domestically in the U.S., I do think that his main priority in South Asia will be the situation in Afghanistan. The Taliban insurgency is has never been stronger. Violence is intensifying to levels not seen in years. And a very nascent peace process between the Afghan government and the Taliban is really struggling. So I think that for the Biden administration, its plan in Afghanistan will be and should be its main priority in South Asia. It's going to need to make a lot of decisions very quickly related to its future troop posture in the country and also involving its role in the fragile peace process.
What happens as far as the talks between the Taliban and the United States and Afghanistan?
Well, what's interesting is that the talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban have really slowed down in recent weeks. And I think one reason for that is that each side wants to wait and see what the U.S., what the Biden administration does. And the Biden administration has not really said all that much, at least not publicly, about its intended policy in Afghanistan. But there is indeed an agreement concluded by the Trump administration and the Taliban back in February of last year, which calls for all U.S. troops to be out of Afghanistan by the end of April or early May, so long as the Taliban has upheld its commitment to sever ties with al-Qaeda. So that's going to be a big question for this new administration. What does it do if it concludes by the end of April or early May that the Taliban has not severed its ties with al-Qaeda? Will the Biden administration try to get tough on the Taliban and hold its feet to the fire and say, well, we're not leaving, we're not pulling out the rest of our troops until you make it quite clear that you are severing your ties with al-Qaeda? And given that Biden has long looked at Afghanistan through the lens of counterterrorism, I would think that for him it would be important to ensure that he's doing everything possible to get the Taliban to stop cooperating with al-Qaeda. Now, will the Taliban actually be willing to play ball in that regard? That remains to be seen. And at the end of the day, I think the Biden administration will have limited patience. It's not going to want to have Afghanistan on its policy radar all that much. It will want to eventually wash its hands of the situation by effecting a responsible withdrawal of the remaining U.S. forces. But the timing, the sequencing at this point, that's all up in the air.
What about Pakistan, India, other South Asian countries?
Yeah, I expect there to be a fair amount of continuity with the Biden administration and the Trump administration when it comes to policy toward Pakistan and India. The Biden administration will look at its relationship, will look at the U.S. relationship with India as a priority. There has long been strong bipartisan consensus in Washington for a deep security partnership with India. That won't change. The Biden administration will view China, like the Trump administration, as a strategic threat and will look to India as a key country to work with the U.S. to push back against China. With Pakistan, very different. Again, like with Trump, I think that Biden will want the relationship with Pakistan to be a workable one, but a relatively limited one, one that for Biden will revolve around trying to get Pakistan to help pressure the Taliban to reduce its violence and to sever ties with al-Qaeda. And I think there also could be some grounds for cooperation on counterterrorism issues, particularly efforts to combat Daesh, or the ISIS, the Islamic State terror group, which has a presence mainly in Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan. But beyond that, I really don't see much scope for Biden wanting to expand the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. And that's just because the relationship with India will be a priority. And I think that Pakistan's close alliance with China will make it difficult for the Biden administration to justify expanding its relationship with the Pakistanis.
If China continues to make inroads in Pakistan, which it's trying to do, obviously, doesn't that become more important?
Well, absolutely. And we've seen a trend over the last few years that China has been intensifying its investments and its broader footprint in Pakistan, mainly through the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is the Pakistan component of China's Belt and Road Initiative. There has, however, been some loss in momentum of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Pakistan has become more cautious given its own economic struggles, and it has not wanted to take on new loans and has not wanted to commit to many new projects with China. But indeed, that Chinese investment in Pakistan will continue. And this is something that the Trump administration, during its last 2 years in power, had been openly critical of. And I imagine that we'll see the same from the Biden administration. You know, it's interesting, there's a trend here that even though Biden's going to come to power with an incredibly different worldview from Trump, very different policies, in many South Asian countries, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, you actually are going to see a lot of convergence, a lot of similarities between Biden and Trump.
That was the Wilson Center's Michael Kugelman speaking with VOA Asia host Ira Melman. While COVID-19 has kept most of the world inside for the past year, a South African folk musician says he hopes his latest album can lift people's spirits. VOA's Jason Patikan has that story.
In his decades-long career, South African folk musician Vusi Mahlasela has performed with top acts around the world, from John Legend to Ladysmith Black Mambazo. But his latest album is a throwback to his roots. The album, called Shibin Queen, is a tribute to his late grandmother. She supported her family with a small informal bar, or shibin, in Pretoria's Mamelodi Township in the 1960s and 70s. Mahlasela says he wanted to recreate the songs he heard performed at his grandmother's bar, and to do so, he recorded Shibin Queen live, outdoors, and on the same street in Mamelodi where his grandmother once lived.
I dedicated this album to my late grandmother, Ida, who studied the Shibin. It's also dedication to the music that was played then, which is the variety of styles of typical accent of South African music styles, Mbatanga, Marabi, Kwela, and Mbube.
Mahlasela says his grandmother started brewing and selling beer to make ends meet after she was forcibly displaced from her previous home and settled in Mamelodi. At the time, South Africa was under the crush of apartheid. Mahlasela says police would frequently raid the bar and arrest his grandmother. But despite the hardship, Mahlasela says the bar was a place where working folks came together to find joy and relaxation, including in the music that spilled across the tables and into the street.
There were quite a lot of people coming from different places in Johannesburg, Pretoria, Durban, Malawi, Zimbabwe. So it was a place where my grandmother championed the social cohesion. And just like today, you know, like a barman, if you're a barman, you listen to quite a lot of people's stories, their plans, and then also when they are hurt, their sad stories, when they are happy. So my grandmother could also listen to all that.
One song inspired by such barroom tales is Ithemba Lami, a man's lament for the woman who left him. Mahlasela says the music of the Shibin is the music of South Africa. He hopes that his album can help raise the profile of those old styles and the artists who pioneered them.
You know, the music that was played of the Masatinian, Hotela Queens, the Dutch, the Sisters, and everything, whatever. These were the people who were exporting our culture and our music outside South Africa. to the States, to Europe and all that, championing our music. This is our typical sound that we need to pride ourselves with, just like Jamaica, where they have rubber stamped reggae as their music and championed it. My drive here is to champion our accent and our own, you know, typical music.
Fittingly, one song on the album is called Mkulo, which is Xhosa for music.
The lyrics are saying music was there before we were born, and the music is still here. Music makes the work to go smoothly, and music takes away the boredom.
With the COVID-19 pandemic raging in South Africa and the world, there's plenty of boredom to go around as people stay in their homes. Mahlesela himself isn't going on tour just yet to promote the album, but he says he hopes these kinds of songs can once again bring some joy, just like they did at his grandmother's shebeen in Mamelodi.
Through this COVID-19, it has been really difficult for a lot of artists, you know, here in South Africa, musicians, and not only here in South Africa, everywhere. But I think this is the time whereby people need some kind of a relief in some way, some kind of entertainment, and then stories that will uplift them. And I think this album will do that.
Shebeen Queen was released in August by ATO Records. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day by visiting our website at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a tremendous Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the recent horrific terrorist attack that took place in Baghdad. On January 21st, two suicide bombers exploded their vests in the center of the capital. More than 30 people were killed and at least 100 were wounded in the busy marketplace in Tehran Square. The attack was planned and executed to produce maximum casualties. Such a deadly attack against civilians in Baghdad has become rare in recent years. The city has been gradually returning to normal life after the Islamic State's control of large swaths of Iraq and Syria was ended by the U.S.-led global coalition to defeat ISIS. The terror group lost its last stronghold in Raqqa in 2019, although remnants have continued to carry out attacks in both Syria and Iraq. The United States has been drawing down its forces in Iraq. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said during his recent confirmation hearing that he remains concerned about the threat posed by the Islamic State in Iraq and elsewhere. "I support maintaining a small number of U.S. troops to carry out a limited mission focused on advising and assisting Iraqi counterterrorism forces to deal with the continuing threat from ISIS," he told the Senate Armed Services Committee. Spokesman for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Colonel Wayne Morato, said in a tweet that the twin suicide bombing in Baghdad is yet another instance of terrorists killing fellow Iraqis and harms those who seek peace. The U.S. Embassy in Baghdad called the attack a reprehensible act of cowardice that underscores the dangers of terrorism that millions of Iraqis continue to face. In a statement, then-Acting Secretary of State Daniel Smith condemned in the strongest possible terms the January 21st terrorist attacks in Baghdad. "They were vicious acts of mass murder and a sobering reminder of the terrorism that continues to threaten the lives of innocent Iraqis," he wrote. "We extend our deepest condolences to the families of the victims and hope for a speedy recovery of those wounded."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.